Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And there's a lot of things that Feedback Friday is all about. Typically, we cover comments and we cover, very specific questions, I should say, very specific comments. And so what we're going to do today is kind of cover a couple of sidebar conversations and other kinds of questions that I've had from a lot of other people that I have spoken to or that I deal with and or those who have been listening for a while. So let me kind of go down this path of my position, because it has come to my knowledge that some people think that because I am, it always comes across whenever you draw a line. This is just human nature. When a person draws a line, it is always perceived by the other as an absolute line. And sometimes that's not the case. Now, when I look at perversions, when I look at sins, when I look at crimes, those types of things, and kind of they're synonymous, then one can easily deduce that there's a capital offense or a pretty severe position on that. And so when one is dealing with a lot of different issues, I'll tell you one that's kind of come back via feedback to me, is my position on, you know, sexual perversion, homosexual marriage, those types of things. And I'm never, in my very first book, I clearly put it out there that I am not advocating the stoning of people, but I am not going to stand by and let sin and or these paradigms be reclassified as something other than what they really are. Now, when we see these, and I've had some people come to me with some scientific explanations as for why, and I'm not talking about DNA, you know, that a person's homosexual or deviant or what have you because of their genetic disposure or, you know, they're disposed to be that way. What I am saying is that when we take a position, and my position in it, because I understand I'm sitting behind a microphone, and I understand that when I say something, those who are listening and those who hear this, you know, it comes across as a authoritarian or a almost like a despotic plea or a despotic, you know, claim. And so I want to be very clear. Even when I talk about treason, because all of these types of offenses are truly offenses against our society in one way or the other. Some of them are, you know, less subtle. And I even point back to, you know, how this society actually used to treat certain types of crimes. How, you know, we were absolutely, let's just say we weren't very tolerant towards those who stole horses. I mean, you stole a horse, you were hanged, period. It was pretty simple. And that's a pretty severe punishment for, you know, somebody doing that. But look at today. I mean, it's a slap on the wrist if you steal somebody's car and total it or what have you. I mean, in comparison to how we used to be as a society. So we've kind of evolved, but I think in some ways we've evolved for the wrong reasons. We've evolved for wrong purposes because maybe deep in within our society, it is an indictment that we've all softened ourselves because we've all somehow accepted or embraced, you know, become more tolerant towards deviation, sins, and so forth that are anti-societal. And when I say that, that's including, you know, treason, because how many politicians in a chamber, whether that be Congress, a state legislature, what have you. I mean, how many politicians can look around the room? I mean, it's almost like that question that Christ asked every person that was getting ready to throw the stone at the adulteress. You know, he among you who have not sinned, go ahead and cast the first stone. And very specifically, how many people in those chambers have not actually knowingly violated their oath in one way or the other? And then next thing you know that, you know, well, I'm not going to throw a stone, and we kind of go the other way. And we as a society have adopted, you know, not throwing stones. But we have to change that, because when we look at the act of throwing stones, we think of that as it is a capital act, but we have to take away the death, you know, sentence in the act, and holding people accountable. Holding a person accountable is not killing them. Holding a person accountable is not destroying them. Holding a person accountable is just that, an act of saying, you have done this, you have done wrong, you have violated your oath, you have committed some atrocity, and you know you cannot continue doing what you're doing without some form of repentance or what have you. Now, when we live in a Republican form of government, that means that we live by the rule of law. And if the law states something, then that is what the law demands. Now, I'm going down this long path because I want to be clear. I'm not an advocate necessarily for capital punishment. I'm not an advocate for dragging people out. But I am an advocate in stopping this incessant desire to be accepting. And it's almost like, you know, how things have really slipped away from us because we happen to accept. We happen to allow these things to continue. I keep on looking at, and there's lots of people that keep on coming back to me and making comments when I talk about how we've lost, you know, society, how we've lost, you know, our grasp on, you know, our Constitution. Most people want to just blame government and our politicians. And it's our fault, folks. I have to cycle it all the way back around. We're the ones that have been tolerating the violations. Now, to be clear, we've been tolerating it because of our illiteracy. But whose fault is that? Whose fault is it for believing Hillsdale College? Whose fault is it for believing the Heritage Foundation or the John Birch Society? Because on this show, we actually tell you what the framers tell you. Now, I will say this. I'm going to go and get the Heritage, because the Heritage Foundation has come out with a constitution that explains every clause. Or I should say, a guide to the Constitution, which basically, I have the desire of auditing it. So I'm officially putting that out there. I'm going to audit their guide to every clause in the Constitution and see how well their explanation matches up to the ratification debates. That's going to be a lot of work, but I think there's merit in doing this because this actually speaks to the importance of stepping away from the oracles in black robes and how they've been defining the Constitution and actually stepping into the contract itself and the contract negotiations and how it was legally defined. Now, one of the things, and the reason I was starting off going down this path of, because I've been told, you know, I really come across as a rabid, you know, person regarding homosexual marriage and regarding treason and these types of things. I'm really an advocate of actually just deporting people more than anything else. Like Obama, there's no doubt Obama, Clinton, all these folks that have committed outright treason against the United States, I believe that they should be deported. Let me just say this, because I made a post regarding Columbus Day. you know, on the, you know, because Columbus Day was Monday. And I basically, at the end of the day, I said, I hope everybody enjoyed our Columbus Day with what's left of civility in our world today. Because the concept of the Western expanse was expanding civilization and maybe their civilization, but it doesn't matter. This was the nation that was blessed and brought up by the hands of God to actually go forth and subdue the world, whether you like it or not, whether you want to call it colonization or not. Because I'm telling you, if the tribes of India or the Indian tribes of America, I'm sorry, if the Indian tribes of America banded together, formed a union, and even though they skipped getting their own language, you know, down into a characters and a written language and that type of stuff, even though they didn't do that, they become such lovers of war and death, because they were very warring and they were very untrusting. And I mean, because our first encounter in as the white colonists came to America, what in that 1602 or whenever, Jamestown? I mean, the very first winter, the Indians attacked them. I mean, without any cause. And so, I mean, it's so we can't just say that, you know, that this was a really passive society, and that may have been just the one. We do know that there were some passive societies. I believe the Navajos were one. But nevertheless, let's just say they became so industrious that they actually were able to, create ships and basically extend themselves and project force around the world, just like Genghis Khan did. Genghis Khan just went through and just basically went through Asia and Europe and destroyed it, just to prove that he could do that. And I believe that that's what would have happened had the Indian tribes developed to that point where they could project that force. It's not like, and there's a huge difference whether we want to look at the hypocrisy, okay, but the Western civilization was basically like a lamp of Christianity. It was perverted from its beginning from the Roman Catholic Church, but or I should say from that first injection into government, and it was slowly breaking free from the Protestants and so forth. And so when we look at what ended up happening, I think if things would have been reverse, I think that it would have been, you know, a completely different story. I think Europe would have been decimated again. And so nevertheless, however things happened by the divine hand of providence, the Western societies did subdue the earth and actually did create these civilized nations around the world. And are we better for that? Are we better for actually having a written language? Are we better for having technology and science and those types of things? Some people say we're not. Well, I believe that it is innate within man to try to improve. I can't believe that people believe that in this backwards, uncivilized world, that not developing is acceptable. Not making things better for your family is unacceptable, folks. And so in light of my Columbus post, there were a lot of people that, you know, just wanted to go all over the place. And as far as I'm concerned, if the tribes of the Indian tribes of America want to have their own Andrew Jackson, Columbus, you know, I'll just say monuments or statues that they can burn in effigy every year, if that's what makes them feel better, then that's fine. But when you actually, because it's one thing to say, hey, you know, that's terrible. Well, you know, but that's, and in all honesty, Andrew Jackson deserves to be burned in effigy by the Indian tribes of America for what he did. He committed a crime. He violated the Constitution. He killed thousands of Indians. And he should never have done that. The Constitution didn't give him the power to do that. It's really clear. So what do we do? What do we do? Whatever it takes to make you feel better, as long as we're not committing a crime anymore. We can't just continue to do the wrong thing. That's one of the beautiful things about the Constitution. The Constitution does not allow government to pay reparations. In other words, if they're wrong, then we get it right, and we move forward after we get it right. We tried to get it right regarding slavery. We've talked about that lots of times. But the bottom line is, and what I really want to get into is, you know, some of the hate and animosity, and Columbus Day and all of these other things have kind of, you know, really helped come to the surface of where we are, especially with what's going on in Israel. Now, I've been hearing and seeing posts that anti-Semitism in America has been rising, and you have to be a fool. You have to be a fool to say, nah, that's not true. But because I know people that really, you know, come across as they're anti-Semitic. And I understand what they're saying, but it's like almost judging white people for being white, being anti-Semitic because are there no good Jews? You know, it's one thing to see how the Jews, you know, because Mark Erbach, a Masonic Jew, in his book, Believe, and it's a good book, he points out how four Jewish families, that basically gave us this world of pornography we have today. I mean, they were the funders, the financiers, and the pushers of pornography in America. And so I don't know, I've never done the research on this, but, you know, they've been pretty involved in doing some pretty bad things. But does that make the entire race of Jews bad? Does that make the entire, you know, when that happens with what white people have done, or with what black people have done, or with what any race has done, even the American Indians, regardless of where they have been, we have to look at where we are today, the individuals, and whether, you know, whether they're committing crimes or not, and being held accountable and improving, and being civil, being, you know, the mutual respect, developing mutual relationships and mutual respect with others. An enlightened society does not go around with a scorched earth attitude. An enlightened society understands that that is just divisive and destructive. We have to be unifying. We have to actually start coming together. The Constitution was the epitome of that. The Constitution actually put America on a path of enlightenment that surpassed every nation in the history of mankind. And so, and I mean that, folks. I truly mean that. There has been no other nation. As a matter of fact, it has been it has been foreordained, because the framers clearly said that this Constitution was inspired by him. And I'm telling you that it was the God's plan of globalism in America. I mean, that's a pretty profound statement right there. So when we start looking at anti-Semitism, we can also see anti-Christianity growing and growing as well. Now, I want to dive into this concept because this has come up in the past week as well. Theocracies in America. Folks, I'm here to tell you that the United States, the federal government, has no dog in any fight regarding religion. However, they do have a dog in the fight of determining whether something is antithetical to liberty or not. Communism is antithetical to liberty. Can the United States government actually come out and say that communism is unsuitable to be here in America because it is about subjugating people in a government form? Instead of using plantations, it's using the halls of government to subjugate people. So if we're going to be anti-slavery, we have to actually come out and say communism has no place in America. Now, when we go a little bit further and look at the theocracies, you've heard me say this on my show as we've gone through the ratification debates, that the religion of Islam is unsuitable for America, for any U.S. citizen, because it is a religion of subjugation. It embraces slavery, demitude. It embraces things of actually forcing people, taking away their liberty and forcing them. It doesn't matter, you know, this war they have against Israel. It is the fundamental tenets of Islam to actually take away a person's liberty. And when you actually speak out against Islam, you've put a target on your back. You are now the evil, you know, whatever words they use, it doesn't matter. I mean, you get onto their radar, and they put out contracts to kill people that speak out against them. In other words, they're not very tolerant towards an open exchange of ideas. They are antithetical. Fact is, the fact that they even have these lists of people, there's a guy that sort of Sal something, anyway. I mean, he was a heretic from them, from that faith. And I'm just telling you, folks, it is incompatible for any citizen of the United States to be a member of Islam. The framers, as I said when we were covering this in the South Carolina debates, they did not understand that faith. They actually thought that, you know, it was a redeeming faith. They didn't look into the ideologies, into the details of how it was another form of slavery, basically to cast upon mankind or cast upon the culture and those people that they govern. So, as we kind of start peeling back and start looking at where we really need to go, and as we start getting sucked into, you know, where do you stand regarding what's happening in Israel? Well, let me talk about this first. We're going to be going into break soon. But one of the things that's interesting, because I've actually made some comments, because I don't like getting into, you know, talking about doctrine, philosophy, and those types of things behind the mic, because 9 times out of 10, then that actually people consider that written down as scripture. And I don't want that to happen, because even when people hear me say what I've said as I started off regarding homosexual marriage, that is not necessarily scripture. That's just something that is taken in the context of what I am talking about and can be easily taken out of context in the grand scheme of things. So Israel has been operating on a 7-year agrarian calendar, and it's called the Shemitah, which basically is every 7 years, or actually after 6 years of working the land, Israel is to actually rest the land. In other words, it is a Sabbath for the land itself. And in the Holy Book, I think it's Leviticus or wherever it is, or the Torah, when a property or owner or what have you, if you have a slave, you know, somebody that was indebted to you, they borrowed money, they couldn't pay it back, so they became a slave to you, they were to be set free on that 6th year, or after the harvest of the 6th year. And everything was expunged. They then go, and if they come back because they'd rather work for you because, you know, you've treated them justly, you've treated them fairly, and, you know, because they just can't do it on their own, then it's their choice to be enslaved to you for another 6 years after that 7th year of rest. Because during that 7 years, you really shouldn't be requiring any labor. Now, here's an interesting thing, because when we look at the agrarian cycle, what's different with any other industry or any other business? Should you not rest? Is it only, see, what's happened is Israel has kind of affixed this because we've grown out of the agrarian world. You know, it took millennia to do that, but we've finally gotten into manufacturing, fabrication, some services, and what have you. And so if the world was truly following this principle, then everybody would rest. In other words, you better be saving money up, folks. You better be saving your money up over the 6 years for the 1 year of not working at all. you know, for actually taking a year off from working and manufacturing. Just imagine what the world would be like if you couldn't get an airplane flight. You just basically hunkered down for 1 year in resting from your daily toils of surviving. We'll be right back after this promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so anyway, so I started doing the research on this because there's been a lot of information regarding the Shemitah, and I maybe mispronounced that, folks, and I don't want to try to always claim that I'm just bad with names, but it's not a talent of mine, and so, but I'm trying, and I'm trying to pronounce that correctly, and later on, when I'm trying to think in my mind, I'll completely just, because I'm looking at actually the spelling right here. I usually don't do show prep, but when it comes to trying to remember these types of things, I actually write a little bit of this down. So, anywho, when I look at this, the Shemitah, we were told that the Golden Jubilee, and I actually believed it, that the Golden Jubilee was was occurring this year, and it was just ending. And all of the information that I had read through this, you know, I'll just say an internet news source was incorrect. And, you know, and actually, so here, this is my position. What is correct? Because I actually went online and looked at the, you know, a Jewish layout of the calendar for the Golden Jubilees. And technically, the last Golden Jubilee began in 2022. And it ended, it began in 2021 and it ended in October 2022. And so the very first year of this new Shemitah cycle is 2023, is the 2023 year. And here's an interesting little tidbit, because there may be somebody else that's kind of connected this. It's been 50 years. It's been 50 years since Israel was attacked. And that's when Egypt attacked Israel 50 years ago in 1973. Irony, right? The fact is that Israel was, you know, I'll get into some of this in just a second here. So as we look at this Jubilee, and they're saying that the Jubilee actually ended, the Golden Jubilee ended in October, because that's the agrarian harvest, right? At some point in late September, October timeframe, when the harvest is done, then you start the new cycle, you know, preparing the land to be, you know, planted or to be, you know, put to rest or what have you. But anyway, you do that cycle, you know, at the end of the agrarian cycle is the harvest. So as I look at, and I know this may seem, you know, like really obscure stuff, but when we look at Revelations is actually laid out in a seven-year plan or a seven-year cycle, right? Israel will be attacked and be at war for 3.5 years. And Israel will then have and finally declare peace with the enemies of the world, or you know, with those who are trying to destroy it, and this peace will be so monumental that Israel will convert its swords into plowshares. In other words, it will turn its back in having to worry about a defense and or a defense mechanism. Now, I'm here to tell you, and actually, I believe that the best thing for Israel would have been that it became a state in the Union instead of an independent. And well, so what is a state in the Union? A state in America, in the Union of this Constitution, every state is an independent and sovereign nation. Now, this goes back to the conversation I had regarding theocracies in America. And as I was basically saying, and I was explaining to these folks that, and I, this is in my very first book as well, that every colony in America, when the Constitution was ratified, every state in the United States had a state-sponsored religion. So in other words, states are not held to the Establishment Clause. In other words, when we look at the Bill of Rights and the origins of the Bill of Rights did not get applied to the states. It only got applied to the states because of the 14th Amendment. And this is, I think, the divine hand of providence once again. When I look at the 14th Amendment and taking away the Establishment Clause so that the states could actually have the governments of the states can have a relationship with religion or religions. Now, at the time, each state chose its own religion. But how great would it have been if every state, instead of actually, you know, standing up and having a single relationship, would have been nurturing and developing an open relationship with all Christian faiths. See, John Adams made an assertion to the king of the Ottoman Empire, the ruler of the Ottoman Empire, when they basically said, hey, America's a Christian nation. And he said, no, we weren't. John Adams was absolutely blatantly and flat out lied because he was speaking for the United States, which was only a general government. He actually thought that the general government of this union, what we call our federal government, was the nation itself, when it really wasn't. This is just helps you understand that the framers, like John Adams, did not understand the Constitution, did not understand this general government was a service government. It was basically a subdued or subjugated government to support the needs of the states. In other words, it was the bedrock for its footing so that the states could grow vertically and not, you know, horizontally. So that as we admitted more and more states to the Union, the general government would grow in its foundation, but not grow outside of its framework. In other words, it could do things unconstitutionally. It was there to support and serve the states to do what it needed to do. And instead, the federal government completely it inverted. It basically got on top of the states and subdued the states, and it basically is contained and captivated and subjugated the states. It does not have the authority to do that. And see, John Adams, his purview or his paradigm was that. He really believed that the federal government was over the states and not there under and supporting. But bottom line, he claimed that we weren't Christian when we were. And I hope I can get this all in because I've got just less than 20 minutes and this gets deep. So can a state have a theocracy? Yes, but it would be a mistake to do that. It would be better for a state, this is GR's paradigm, it would be better for a state to have an open relationship with all Christian faiths. with all Christian faiths. That way it doesn't monopolize, and it makes sure that one faith doesn't become, you know, the dominator, where like it did at the, in their day. Virginia, the Anglican Church, was actually having Baptist, you know, ministers or Baptist missionaries arrested for practicing, you know, proselyting without a license, because the license had to come from the Anglican Church. So if you've never read Madison's Remonstrance on Religion, folks, and you have this idea of Christianity and a biblical constitution and so forth, you probably need to read that. You probably also need to read his essay on property. We really need to start placing context to the federal government. The Constitution was designed to protect the states and what it chose and how it chose to basically protect and nurture its own people. As long as, because this is where the 14th Amendment comes in, as long as those states did not step on the privileges and immunities guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution, which means the individual right of religious, you know, practice, religious worship, the individual's religious worship. In other words, you can, you know, go in your home. Now, states had a right to actually have and do have and establish decency laws so that Satanists don't have orgies in the middle of the street. That behavior is unacceptable, even if you want to call it a religious. But today, we've become so godless that they could start getting away with that, because most people would be accepting that and not understanding the importance of decency laws. Oh, well, it's the right of religion. No. Your right does not trample on another person's right to not have their children see that. And so this is why, you know, we start looking at the Bill of Rights and how it was being applied for the privileges and immunities to protect the people. So as I start explaining to this group of people this past week regarding theocracy in America, it was very, very clear in the way the 14th Amendment was written, the Establishment Clause was not included. And most people miss this. Why is this so important? When we look at who does what best, we can look at government, and fighting wars is, you know, that's their, you know, the creme de la creme. That is their essence. That's what they do best, is killing people, fighting wars, prosecuting death, and so forth. And so when we look at compassion, government is not good at that. And as a matter of fact, government, as in the framework of dominance, warfare, and everything else, if you give them the ability to use compassion or have compassion, they will use that with warfare tactics. And this is what they've been doing. Every state has a need for compassion services, and at that point in time of the Constitution, up to the 1850s, up to the middle of the 19th century, when we look at compassion services, they were done by the church. Education was done by the church. Actually, help me out here. Our healthcare system was done by the church, because they went to these church schools and actually had, you know, this education. And as they got smart, they went to these church hospitals, St. Mary's, St. Joseph's. If you look at the old institutions of healthcare prior to our godless secular, you know, tangent that we went on, you know, as a matter of fact, there are a few states in the union that do not have religious medical systems at all. And one of the ones that really kind of stands out, because it never developed, is Wyoming. There was never a church that actually went into Wyoming to develop, because they just didn't have the population. That's why when you look at all the hospitals, I don't think out of all of the hospitals, there's maybe just one or two that has a religious connotation. They all were done by secular because of the needs of the people. The state had to step in. And most of the people, I don't know how happy they are in Wyoming regarding their health care, but I'm believing that Obamacare has not helped them at all, even though Obamacare has poured millions of dollars into Wyoming. It has been to subjugate them. And so back to this whole point, who does compassionate services better? It would be the churches. So why would government want to step into doing something when they can't even compete with what a church does? Right? It's like, who does nurturing better? Now, it doesn't mean that all women are better, point blank, you know, that a man can't be nurturing. But women are better nurturers, period. Men are really good at going and hunting and killing. And so they may be stereotypes, but they're stereotypes for a reason, because it is innate within these genders, these sexes, to behave better in doing this than in doing that. And so, you know, this kind of goes down, again, I talk about this, to the divine roles and the divine layout of, you know, our biological makeup, that there are divine responsibilities for a father and a divine responsibility for a mother. But I'm not trying to inflict my paradigm or my view. This is one of the reasons why I really try to stay out of this. And as a matter of fact, I bend over backwards in my book telling people it doesn't matter what my religion is. What matters is your relationship with your Savior, whoever that is. And hopefully it's Christ. And hopefully it's a very intimate relationship, because that is the essence. That is the most important relationship that we have here on this earth. Next would be our relationship with our spouse. And putting things into context like that, then we can start looking at how important it is for compassionate services to actually be left to, you know, our faith, to allow us, we the people, because do you believe that America is being blessed because government comes and takes money from you and gives to those who need it or who are entitled to it? That's how it is today. When we do it by the church, those who are entitled would not get any money. They'd actually have to become churchgoers. They'd actually have to be members of the church to actually receive the benefits. So, you know, the whole point of compassionate service is not to help, you know, it is a cruel system that gives money to the addict instead of helping the addict overcome their addiction. It is a cruel system that actually feeds the addict and allows them to die at their own hands. That is a godless system. And so when we start looking at how and the ways we need to do this, you know, folks, we need to start changing our paradigm. We need to actually start, you know, accepting the fact that we need to go back to and integrating compassionate services and a relationship with religion in our communities and relationship with religion, you know, instead of government for those types of services. Which means, folks, for those religions to do that, you're going to have to tithe. You're going to have to sacrifice. And when it comes to our government and actually its functions, so it doesn't become so onerous in you know, executing the laws, enforcing the laws, you're going to have to do that. You're going to have to be a part of the militia. This is why in a civil society, people are engaged in every way, but we've become such a carnal society that we've allowed ourselves to actually go to work and take care of ourselves, go watch the games, and indulge our own desires instead of serving one another. So who's really, and what is really the righteous path forward? So going back to Israel and Israel today, and this is where I've wanted to set this stage, and I think I did a decent job in doing this, that there are lots of people that are standing with Israel. And at the risk of offending and being lambasted by all sorts of Christians and, you know, Islamists and so forth, I do not stand with Israel. I stand with God. I stand with the Constitution. And if Israel wants to actually ensure that the citizens of Israel have the protections of liberty, then Israel will petition America to become a state in this union, that Israel will adopt, you know, our legal system, Israel will adopt our language, it will basically integrate into the United States. Now, there are all sorts of biblical references that, you know, that won't happen. But let me just say this. If Israel became a state in the United States, it doesn't remove its sovereignty. It only creates a relationship and a commitment to liberty. Because if Israel all of a sudden had a prime minister or governor that wanted to subjugate the people and take away their rights, that governor would be removed if he was in the United States and we were following the Constitution. In other words, when we look at a theocracy functioning, can a theocracy function in America? Yes, as long as that theocracy is only on the compassion services side and not driving your government. In other words, your government must be Republican in form. In other words, your counties would be able to select their representatives. The people would select their representatives in the county. And then when it came to the representation in the state, the people and their county government would select their representatives. The people would have the House and the county would have the Senate. And every county would have representation based on these standards of the federal constitution. This is why I said this a while ago. We actually have to adopt, every state needs to adopt the federal model in its constitutional government. And in so doing, it lays out this, I'll call this equalizer, this equilibrium regarding a balance between the two sovereign bodies within our legislature, just like with Congress, that if the county actually has their suffrage in the Senate and the people have their suffrage, they will keep each other in check. But when all of a sudden, you know, you lose that suffrage and it goes into the hands of the globalist or into the hands of the people, then we suffer either from a democracy or from despotism. Either way, it doesn't bode well. So can you actually have, you know, a religious doctrine to where you actually, you know, you don't allow the sell of alcohol on the Sabbath? Yes, you absolutely can. You don't have a right to that. As a matter of fact, Utah, for years and years, I think they still do outlaw the sale of hard alcohol on the Sabbath. You can actually have a theocracy, but the theocracy isn't the government itself. It is the people that actually have laws that they base that all operate within a Republican form of government. You know, whether we like it or not, because this is what happens. And this actually came up because when we talk about a constitution and the will of the people, or I should say the will of the people of the counties, a majority of the counties of the state, you know, the whole design was to keep population centers from controlling the federal government and population centers from controlling the state government. And so if you look at how Illinois, and actually we'll use Illinois. Let's say Illinois has a gold mine that is out in one of the very rural counties, and the people of Chicago say we want to basically nationalize that under the state of Illinois and take that property away from whoever owns that. Take it away from the county who owns that. In other words, that gold mine sits within a county. Well, if based on a democracy today and based on the way constitutions are today, they can actually take that away with a very easy bar to say, we're nationalizing that. Had they had the federal model, it would have required 3/4 of the counties to do that. And here's the thing. Here's the rub. The county itself that has that gold would be able to dictate, because I understand property laws and so forth, folks, but when it comes down to government, when the people actually decide to make something constitutional and they amend their constitution regarding mineral rights, then you can actually then say, hey, all mineral rights belong to the counties. All mineral rights belong to the states. Today, right now, this facade, it's illegitimate. But the claim by the federal government is all mineral rights are owned by the federal government. Show me that in the Constitution. We've been going through the Constitution. It wasn't listed in Article 1. And as a matter of fact, we've gone through the entire, you know, from Article 1 to Article 7, and it was not listed. So who actually has the mineral rights? Right now, legally, not one government has it. But let's just say you find gold and a person on their property is sitting on top of this huge gold mine. They're rich. No. Because what would happen and what can happen is that the state would come in and say all minerals that have not been harvested within this state are belong to either the state. Now, with the way the constitutions are with the democracy, that would be tragic. But if the state actually had a federal model, the counties would protect themselves and say, no, that actually belongs to the county. And then create this symbiotic relationship, maybe, but the state would basically, you know, regardless of who and how that money is coming out, how that gold is coming out, bottom line, as it converts over to the state or over to the county, now the county becomes very rich in being able to port that out. The best thing to do would actually create a mineral rights that would be quasi-shared. Because you have no idea where those mineral rights are. But I will tell you that the juvenile mentality in amending a state constitution, if you had the federal model, the juvenile mentality would be, oh, we want to amend the constitution so that each county has the full gain of what its mineral rights are. And now capturing mineral rights within the state and using that federal model that that each state would be able to gain it. I believe that when we look at the union itself within the state, that it would be better to ensure that the state that possesses those minerals would have the lion's share of the benefit of those minerals, but it should share a good percentage with the remainder of the state so that it shares those blessings. And how to divide that? That requires the wisdom of King Solomon. I don't possess. But I am just telling you that when we talk about sovereignty and when we talk about how to be able to make these decisions, whether it's a theocracy or whether it's over the minute details of mineral rights and how they're to be shared, bottom line, right now there aren't any. And right now there is this huge problem that is just sitting under the surface. Once we start peeling the orange back or the onion back, we're really going to start hitting these things as we realize that the federal government has stolen all of the wealth from all of us. Because it's not like they're sharing that. It's not like, you know, the states are sharing that. And I'm here to tell you, folks, it's about time the parents actually got together and pulled in. And this is the whole point of Republic Review, that the parents actually sit into to get together in one room and have the conversation. What are we to do with our child that's gotten out of hand? Don't make the mistake of making juvenile decisions that quickly benefit you at the expense of everybody else. Everybody in that room, you never know who might actually have a diamond mind. You never know who actually might have, you know, the mind of unobtainium, the next metal that is so precious that it actually shapes the future of the world. Let's actually always think what's best collectively in governing ourselves to ensure that we don't give up the ship nor give up our liberties. That's the whole point of Republic Review. And with that, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.